right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. That's right, and I'm talking really fast so I can squeeze as much out of this today as I can.
At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Charlotte Silver. Charlotte is a regular reporter for the Electronic Intifada, and she's been reporting from and on Palestine since 2010. And we're going to be talking with Charlotte about New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's latest attack on the BDS movement, the movement of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. And before that, we'll be talking with Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, an advocate for Bob Avakian and his new Synthesis of Communism, and she's also the founder of StopPatriarchy.org. And we're going to be talking with Sansara about the Supreme Court ruling overturning the Texas anti-abortion laws. And opening the show up, we have a very special surprise. A few days ago, I got an email from a friend who said, "Hey, would you be interested in..." I said, yes, there's no hesitation, okay? No hesitation at all. And who we're having is we're having a man named Alo Black. He's a soul singer, soul artist, lyricist, vocalist, and songwriter, joins us in studio today for Music and Conversation. He recently said, "My purpose for music is positive social change." And he started as a hip-hop artist in the 1990s and then transformed from rapper to singer without discarding his hip-hop spirit and social awareness. Let's just jump into this, Alo. Welcome to the show, man.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. I got to tell you, man, it's really interesting because when I started listening to your music, to your work, it took me in a lot of different directions, all of which were really interesting,
great,
to say the least. But it also raised a lot of questions for me.
For instance, in an upcoming show, you've decided to perform some songs that might surprise people.
The songs that I've chosen for this show are songs that have been an inspiration to me as an artivist, as an activist and an artist, songs that were part of social movements of the past and a couple from the present, songs like Marvin Gaye's What's Going On and Joni Mitchell's Big Yellow Taxi and Aretha Franklin's Think and Sam Cooke's Change Is Gonna Come. And they are some of my favorite songs. I found myself in rehearsals getting choked up at the lyrics and, you know, the songs that have touched me for so many years, now I get to actually sing them on stage.
Well, I'm glad you had the experience of getting choked up because I have to tell you, a few of the songs that you do of your own now actually had me choked up like crazy at some points. And one we're going to talk about, a couple of them we'll talk about, but in particular, the things that happen between what the system says about people and what it does to people and how it shapes people's lives and what you say about that, right? Mm. And also the point about the Christmas song, Merry Christmas, Mr. Brown. We're going to go out with that just so you know, all right? And you can tell a little story about it before we go out. But that song had me sobbing.
Okay? Yeah.
That was such a beautiful piece and a very heavy piece, and it's something people need to hear. But I want to jump into what you were just talking about. As a songwriter and artivist, you have this basic approach to things. And as a songwriter, you once said that you aim to make your music make positive social change. Let's talk about that a little.
Sure. Well, starting with the lyric. Taking cue from Bob Marley and Michael Jackson and Nina Simone, folks who would, with their lyrics, discuss the issues and present the messages that they wanted people to hear. I try to come at my music with that perspective, with the perspective of I can put these words together that'll allow people to have a mantra of self-determination and self-sufficiency. So how can I do this as well as my forefathers and foresisters did in music? And that's one way. So I do it with the lyrics. Another way is with my visibility. You know, I get to be on TV and do interviews and magazines and radio. How can I speak about the issues that mean something to me and use that time and that space as a platform? And the other is with my music videos. Not all of my songs have a direct message about social transformation. So I use my music videos as an extra piece of the story. Wake Me Up was a song that was fantastically popular around the world. The story in the song is quite vague. So I made it specific in my music video visually by associating it with the fight for immigration reform in the U.S. Love is the Answer in lyrical form is quite vague. It didn't speak to any specific topics, but in conversation with Community Coalition of Los Angeles, they said, what would be nice is to have more awareness around what was being called willful defiance, where students were being suspended for kind of minor infractions. And those suspensions then lead to them not going to school and potentially being influenced by elements in the street. And it's a kind of a downward spiral. They call it the school-to-prison pipeline. So I wanted to address that in the music video. Being able to make these PSAs with my access to millions of eyeballs and millions of ears, I think is another way that I'm affecting my goal of trying to create some positive social change.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Alo Black. And Alo is a songwriter, a soul singer, and an artivist. And his work will hit you both at your heart and at your brain.
You know, it's really interesting because when you talk about millions of ears, you're literally talking about millions of ears. Mm. I mean, and your videos do. They really do bring a whole other aspect to the song. I mean, the songs themselves are beautiful and they're really very moving. You know, and just your voice, we'll talk about this a little later too. Your soul voice is very soulful and really just something that just penetrates people's hearts. But there's also this thing of the idea that you have these videos and you actually put together a picture, a visual picture of what's going on and the impact. Like, for instance, the one on Wake Me Up. That scene there is so powerful. And folks, you have to go to YouTube and you put in Alo Black in YouTube. Just Google that and you're going to come up to a whole, I'm telling you, there's like truckloads of these videos, right? And the thing is that each and every one, and some of them are looking at it saying, 35 million people have looked at this and listened to this. And you're thinking about the broad impact you're having, but also the content of that. For instance, raising this thing of this is where you're at, this is where society's at. And how can you sit there and not step up against this when you're seeing that what's portrayed in there, the young woman, a woman going to try and see her husband separated. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what it is. It's the story of this woman and her husband's working in this country, and she's in, I guess, Mexico, and she's, you know, sitting there, and she's trying to figure out how to get by. She gets picked up, you know, when she tries once, and that determines everything about her. Her life becomes this fight to do this, and meanwhile, on the other side, you're showing these human relations and how it both tears people apart, but also how much people really, one, need each other and need each other in a bigger sense as well.
Yeah, I think finding the humanity in the story is really important, and offering that to an audience that may either accidentally happen upon the songs or purposefully seek out the videos is important. And then for those who are sort of rubbed the wrong way, it creates a tension and they have to think about what it is that makes them feel strangely about it. And sometimes it comes up in interviews and I get to speak my piece and hopefully educate a few people.
Well, it won't come up here, okay? No, but, you know, it's also, that does say something about what you've also talked about doing with your art, which is consciously standing up against and posing your art against all the various forms of misogyny and all the other trash that gets put out as you know, music to be sold. And it's sort of aimed at shaping the thinking of a whole generation of people.
I believe there has to be a counterpoint, you know. If there is a message on the radio that says live fast, die young, then I've got to write the song that says, you know, I don't want to die young. I want to grow old and gray and have grandkids and great grandkids, because I believe that's important. If it's going to be primetime radio where 3-year-olds are listening to this music and ingesting this and it's becoming part of their psyche, then we have to have a balance. I mean, I would prefer to not have it in primetime at all. You know, I mentioned before in a few interviews, one of the most popular songs at the radio at the time that Lamar Odom was in a coma from drug abuse was I Can't Feel My Face, which is, to me, kind of is really disturbing. And I look at all of the checkpoints along the way, the A&R who approved the song, the president of the record label who approved the song, the radio executive who took it to radio, the radio programmer who said, yes, this is perfect for 3-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 13-year-olds to listen to at prime time on radio. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, a lot of adults made mistakes along the path in allowing this kind of message to make it to mainstream. I don't mind. I don't want to censor it. Create your art. Release your art. Publish your art. But the adults along the way have to check and balance when we're going to play this. It's, you know, just like television. There's a there's a rating system, and we play certain content at different hours of the day because of who is available, who might be available to consume.
But there seems that there's something that you also pay a lot of attention to, which is, you know, you once referred to that we live in a culture of flack. And all this stuff that comes down on people. I mean, look, you know, it is so easy to hear. And I have to say, it's like you think of somebody like 2 Chainz and what happens to him, right? And the kind of music that he puts out. Or other people. And not saying, oh, let's attack these people. But I was thinking even in terms of how when big things happen in society, for instance, he was moved to take a stand around Mike Brown. You know, he was actually, and he created something that, frankly, I was surprised that he created. And brought in a lot of other people from his sort of side of the art world. But there's also this thing that you've talked about the need to really, in a culture of flack, for people like yourself and others, and for people who are consumers as well, to actually stand up and not let the profit, you know, the profiteers sort of determine what actually is it that's getting into people's heads, you know, which is extremely important.
It's really important. It's a difficult position to be in because most of my peers, and I say peers meaning artivists, don't get the opportunity to be in the public on the public airwaves, on mainstream. So, you know, my goal is to try to bring more, you know, more people along in the ranks. But and it's not easy, you know, just to get in, you got to do a little dance to get in. And once you're there, how do you stay there? So, you know, Michael Jackson was good at it because he could, if you look at the lyrics on most of his songs, you could barely understand them anyway because he was always kind of, you know, grunting through his notes. But when he wrote the lyrics, they were quite special lyrics about humanity, about coming together as one, about violence and about the evils of oppression. And, you know, he just packaged it in these beautiful pop compositions, you know, that made you dance first, and then eventually you got the lyric. I think that's important. Bob Marley did the same. Like, you love the way the songs start. You're dancing before you get the first lyric. But that first lyric, old pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I from the merchant ships. You know how many, you know how many ex-slave owners' descendants are singing those songs? Do you know? And they probably don't even realize what they're saying as they get high. But it's there. Mm-hmm. It's there.
You know, it's interesting because when you were talking about Michael Jackson, I'm going to hit at this a little bit later, but, you know, that the one song that always stands out to me in terms of one I think that shocked a lot of people when they heard it and began to hear it shortly before he died and then after it is They Don't Really Care About Us.
Amazing.
You know? Yeah, and it's, I mean, when you look at that first, the one that's filmed here that's based in this country, and when you see all the faces in there and you see and you hear the people singing this song and you're watching their action, and it drives home so much about the nature of this society and also the character of the people that are oftentimes thrown into jail, that are also, you know, all kinds of things. It gives you a concentration of the screwed up social relations in this society. And it's a very heavy song and a very beautiful song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the one that comes to mind is from Michael Jackson is You're Just Another Part of Me, which I always thought was a love song. Because he says, you know, we're sending out a major love. We're sending out a major love. And then he says, you're just another part of me. So I think that's talking to, but really he's saying anyone and everyone around the world is part of me. And I am part of you. Mm-hmm. And like, those are the kind of things you don't get as a kid. But when you get older and you actually look at the lyrics, that was a big pop song. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's really special what he was able to do, and I give him a lot of credit for it.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to, well, first, I should remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Aloe Black. And I want people to know how to spell your name, okay? It's Aloe Black. You know, I want to play something. I was going to play one song, but, you know, I'm really leaning against it. I want to play something that really, I want to give people a sense of... And there's a reason I wanted to do this. I wanted to play a little bit from I Need a Dollar.
Okay.
All right? And then I want to talk about that for a minute. So, Teddy, that's track 6. Can you play that?
I need a dollar, dollar, dollar. That's what I need. Hey, hey. Well, I need a dollar, dollar, dollar. That's what I need. Hey, hey.
Welcome back. That's I Need a Dollar, and it's by Aloe Black, and I need to talk to you about that, man. That's what I need. Let's talk about this a little bit. One thing, when I read that your influence on that, what influenced you on that?
Well, I was listening to field recordings of chain gang workers singing their own kind of made-up folk songs, and I Need a Dollar was my version of one of those, you know, field songs. That was inspiring me at the time. I was going through these old, I don't know if they were Lomax recordings or who they were, but a friend of mine gave me a CD, and they inspired those lyrics. And then I started writing the song kind of as I drove around town and at different points in time. It was a song that kind of took years to write because I never thought of it as, oh, I'm going to write this and record this and release it. I started writing it in 2005. Just in my head as something to do, as a puzzle. And then when I went to record my second solo album in 2009, I had already completed pretty much, you know, three verses in my head. So I just recorded it to this jam we did in the studio. It worked.
And it's one of those songs that actually, when you think about that and when you see the video to it, then what you were talking about before, about the sort of like, you can hear that and just hear it. And you've got a whole different picture of it. And then yet when you see the video, it brings in that aspect. And that's what really caught me about this thing of the, you know, listen to the chain gang songs and the farm worker and the worker songs in the fields and stuff, right? And all these kinds of things that actually depict an entire life. And somebody, a friend of mine was Oscar Brown Jr. when he, you know, years ago, and he used to talk about how that influenced him as well. These, you know, listening to these songs of chain gangs and the kind of the shared misery, but also the shared defiance in a certain sense, you know. And so that really got me. And I really wanted to play that because that song and your influence around, you know, what influenced you was really important. And I think that comes to another question, which is the fact that you're a soul singer and you started out hip hop.
Yeah.
And also started out. Why the hell did you ever think the trumpet would be the easiest? This isn't a real question. Because I got to tell you, when you said, because it only had three keys. I did that once, and my nephew gave me a trumpet. And he said, here, you can learn that. And I tried to learn it, and it's still sitting in the case. Right?
Yeah, no.
It's not as easy as it looks.
It really isn't as easy as it looks, and you have to keep it up because the muscles that play the trumpet are, you know, finicky. You lose them if you don't use them.
Yeah. Or you never had them. You can never play. Anyway, you once said that when you're coherent and sober and sane and conscious, you need to have music that sustains that kind of mentality. And when you look at songs like Wake Me Up, and you look at songs like, you know, like what we just played, when you look at I Need a Dollar, you look at, let's see, well, Life's So Hard, all these songs, all of these songs, you look at them, and it is that thing, there's a constant, you know, sort of feeding of the need to actually do that sustenance.
Yeah. You know, when you're young and carefree, there's a time for party music, and then when you get older and you have responsibilities, you still need music. It's sort of the last playground for adults, you know. And but we want to have fun, and there are moments for abandon, but then, you know, there are moments for educating and for consoling and for embracing. So I recognize that what I feel good doing is there's a lack of in the marketplace, in the major music marketplace. There are plenty of people in the underground and indie scene doing it. As long as I've got a foot straddling both worlds, I'm going to try to push as much of the, of my voice in through the mainstream airwaves.
Now, Teddy, I want you to play another song for a minute, all right? It's track 4, and it's called Hello World, and I want to move into a whole other subject off of that one. Hey.
Hello world, it's nice to meet you. I've been waiting for this moment to come my whole life. Hello world, the past is over. It's time for us to come together and make the future right. I had an epiphany one night, looking at the endless star-filled sky. The world is ours.
All right, that's Alo Black with Hello World, and we're talking with Alo Black in studio today. Now, Alo, one of the things that really caught me about this is, you know, and you've paid a lot of attention to this, there's a certain way that people are portrayed, and there's a certain way, and especially people, you know, to be frank, Black and Latino children, from the moment people are born, the way they're portrayed, the kind of box that they're kept in, what's expected of them, and then what happens to them, you know, and this song in particular, it's just, it's such an amazing piece because on the one hand, it's like a soul anthem in a certain sense when you hear this thing. But there's also, when you look at the video, something cracks open, you know, and and you've done a number of pieces like that where you actually are trying to deal with this thing of, you know, the system says that people are just bad by nature of who they are, by the nature of who they are. But then you're arguing that actually there's these different relations in society that people have cooperating within.
Totally different relations. I mean, first of all, the music video was a response to the verdict in the Trayvon Martin case. And so we had the characters in the music video wearing hoodies. You couldn't see their faces. You assume what media has conditioned you to assume. But when you think about it, for any parents out there who have a 13-year-old, when your child was in a hoodie, did you assume that they were going to do something negative? Did you assume that they were bad kids? Probably not. So to what extent should anyone else think the same? And to what extent should our judicial system not protect the innocence of youth, the ignorance of youth, the mistakes of youth?
Well, when you think about that, though, too, because in that video, what you see is exactly that, what you're just talking about. But then you also see, I mean, and I have to tell you, folks, you see a bunch of kids in hoodies, in black hoodies, running through a little liquor store food mart and piling chips and sodas and all this other stuff in. And it's just like, you know, the first thing that comes to somebody's mind, I think, in a lot of ways, if you are conscious of how this works in society, it's like, oh, wait a minute, he's portraying these cats wilding or something, you know, like they, you know, that kind of, they're just going through and they're just ripping stuff. Or you see the guy standing outside in his hoodie and that young woman is with a baby in a stroller, you know? And you think, and he's reaching in, he's getting something, is he going to jack her or something? What's going to happen here?
Yeah.
But then all that gets turned around. And it really says something to me that you're able to actually, you know, you look at this and you kind of pull things back and in the end show the humanity of all these people. And in a really powerful way, you know, it's a very powerful thing that happens at the end. And particularly when you see people of all nationalities, they're this, they're that, they're doing all this, and they're actually doing things that are different social relations to a certain extent, you know, than what has been expected in terms of what we think, you know, what we think when we, and it's true, when you, this society, what people are told to think is that, particularly if you see a Trayvon Martin, he's up to something bad. Hmm. You see you see Michael Brown walking down the street with headphones on and goes into a shop, has a little back and forth, whatever it is, you know, we still don't know what's true about what happened there. But, you know, then he's portrayed, and the attempt is to portray people as just over-the-top gangsters that really don't have a right to live anyway. You know? And it's very heavy what you did with that.
I mean, it's extremely heavy. It's something just a note is Black males only make up about 5 or 6% of the U.S. population, you know. And when you consider the effect that Black males have had on popular culture, from music to entertainment, and then that you also consider the lack of control that we have over really ultimately the final implications that are made about what is Black maleness. you know, especially on the film and TV side, because what you when you see it, it's much more visceral. And so if you have no relationship to, let's say, the Black community or communities of color, what you see is what you expect and imagine. For in the 80s, for a young kid from the suburbs, say, you know, a white kid from the suburbs growing up, who's going to become a cop, and he grew up in the suburbs, white suburbs, and on the, in the 80s, he's watching the news and watching the media. When he becomes a cop as an adult, and his only experiences with Blackness are through the media, his expectations are going to be completely skewed. We're talking about a very small portion of our population in this country, 6%. And the demonization of this 6% is unfathomable.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And look at the percentage. What's the percentage of the people that are in prison that are Black?
Yeah, it's I don't know the exact percentage, but definitely the disproportionate amount.
Well, Black and Latino together is 50% or more. When you look at that. And this is, you know, it's an incredible situation that you're talking with. And that's why I think this point about actually really pulling back the cover on this. And you do a similar thing with Love is the Answer, the video for Love is the Answer, where, you know, again, you show two brothers who have choices. One chooses to hit the books and to do, you know, to play football and do this. And the other brother is living a life and constantly any life. It's, and it wasn't even, that's not presented as a criminal life. It's presented as a kid who does anything. I mean, you know, if you were a kid that, I mean, I did plenty of things that were similar and would not have been, you know, I wouldn't have been treated the same
right.
way. But you're looking at this, and it isn't really a choice that that guy made. And people, because people always say, well, he chose to do that. But there's certain social relations in society that determine what you the choices you have available to make.
Right. I mean, according, I don't know where the statistic is or where the science is from. I just heard it. So if somebody knows, you know, you can correct me on it. But they're saying that our brains aren't fully developed until age 21. So to expect a 13 or 14-year-old to act in a way that is, you know, completely adult-like, he's still got 7 years left on that. So,
yeah, and some of us get to be like much older than that, and we still
it's still not
like,
fully developed. Yes, I totally agree. You get about 70 years to figure it out.
There you go. I want you to do. I want to real quick. Everything that we've been talking to also is related to the song Merry Christmas, Mr. Brown. Can you talk about, just tell people what that is and what led to it, and then we'll start playing and you can leave, and thank you very much.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was really moved by the death of Michael Brown. I happened to be home and had TV on and watching the news and seeing what was happening as it was unfolding, and then going online and seeing the kind of, you know, cell phone footage that people were showing, and it really upset me. And I thought, this is, you know, it's unfortunate as we're going, as we got closer to the holiday season, I just started thinking about all the people who are gone and how their families are probably feeling right now as we're celebrating, you know, family during the season. And you know, Black Friday is trying to sell us our happiness. And I just had to take a moment and pause and send a message out to the families who had lost loved ones. So Merry Christmas, Mr. Brown is the title, but in the song I kind of pay my respects to, you know, the families of Sandra Bland and of Oscar Grant and
Eric Garner.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just
Freddie Gray.
And especially you think Freddie Gray in terms of even they can't even prosecute the cops.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's insane. Anyway, I want to thank you very much for everything you're doing. And hopefully you'll come back, man. We'll get a chance to spend a little bit more time. All right?
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Hello. Great talking with you, man.
It's really all great.
Right. All right.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Brown. Put the angel on your tree. Won't you please accept this gift? Michael's memory from me. Merry Christmas, Mrs. Garner. May your family always cherish every holiday smile and laugh.
that
you ever shared with Eric. Dear Geneva, how I wish you a holiday full of love and joy and cheer.
All right, that's Aloe Black with Merry Christmas, Mr. Brown. And I'm telling you folks, a beautiful, beautiful piece. Look it up on YouTube. Right now, I want to welcome Sansara Taylor to the show. Sansara is a founder of StopPatriarchy.org and an advocate of Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And we're talking today about the recent Supreme Court ruling throwing out at least portions of that Texas law that was such a massive assault on women in Texas and laid the ground for that similar stuff happening all over the country. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, well, let's jump into this. Sorry it's been took a little longer, but it was had to
no,
do it.
I was listening. I dig it. I really appreciated listening in on that interview, so I don't mind a bit.
Good. Well, let's jump into talking with you. What people are looking at this, and they're looking at the Supreme Court decision. A lot of people were stunned by the fact that they actually did that, that they actually cut down the Texas law, or at least part one of the Texas laws that was aimed at stopping women's right to an abortion in Texas and had impact all over the country. What is your assessment of what happened? How should people be looking at this?
Well, yeah, so for people who don't know, on Monday, or maybe you saw the headline briefly, but just to let people know, on Monday, the Supreme Court saw probably the most significant case around abortion rights since the 90s. And what it was is there's been in the recent years, anti-abortion restrictions that have been passed across the country, closing down abortion clinics at record numbers, hundreds and hundreds of laws. I mean, it's been unprecedented. And they've had nothing to do with medical safety, nothing to do with protecting women. They've only been motivated by a motivation to deny women this most fundamental right to access abortion. So a number of them had been working their way up through the courts. Abortion clinics and providers had challenged them. And so a number of these have been working their way up through the courts over the last couple of years. And probably the most extreme law that had been passed in the country was HB2 in Texas. Was heard, the challenge to that was heard by the Supreme Court, and a decision was issued on Monday. And the two major provisions of that law were thrown out. And so this is, you know, I can talk about what that means, but this was a major blow. What had happened in Texas was over 44 abortion clinics had existed. It had been forced because of this law down to 20 clinics because the law had been partially implemented. And if it had gone fully into effect, it would have closed down all but 9 clinics in the entire state that do abortions. And this would have left huge numbers of women who are poor, rural, immigrant women, women who have difficulty accessing abortion hundreds of miles away from the nearest abortion clinic. This already had spiked the level of self-induced abortions, very dangerous things women were doing in the desperate attempt to prevent or terminate an unwanted pregnancy. So this Supreme Court decision threw that out. It said that the clinics that are open will stay open, and it provided a legal foundation for the ones that were closed to reopen, although that's going to be a very, very difficult battle because those clinics laid off staff. A lot of them lost their property. They've been forced to close, so reopening is not an easy endeavor for any medical facility, for any operation. But then the other thing the Supreme Court did is, through this decision, lays a major foundation for a lot of these other restrictions to be challenged across the country. So this was a very, very positive ruling, and it was no guarantee. So it's very important. At the same time, this is not an end, and I feel the need as the days tick on to emphasize this more and more. This is not an end to the vicious assaults on women's right to abortion. This Supreme Court decision does not challenge a lot of the onerous, very, very invasive restrictions, mandatory waiting periods that women are forced to go through, parental consent laws, mandated lies and scripts that the doctors are forced to read to the patients. So it doesn't actually reverse the bulk of the restrictions, which are still very, very onerous and anti-woman. And there's an incredible, well-organized, built up over years, determined anti-abortion Christian fascist movement that is undoubtedly going to react, already is reacting very strongly to this decision. And we can anticipate that they'll feel even more incensed that this country is being taken away from their Christian fundamentalist view of what it should be. And of course, we don't want to see, but we will anticipate more extra legal attack, more harassment at the clinics, more legal challenges where they try to work through and figure out how to work within the loopholes that still exist for them to restrict abortion. So it's a good decision, but it's far from over.
And in terms of how people should be looking at this, because it does raise some questions for people. I know a lot of people have been like thinking, okay, this has been a, and as you're saying, it's a good decision, but there's still a big fight out there. And there's a fight in both an immediate sense and a fight in a longer term sense as well, in terms of how much longer does this stuff go on and how do you stop it? How do you end it?
Yeah, I mean, it is important. This is something I think is really important to take a look at. What is the role of the Supreme Court? And it is the highest judicial body administering over a whole system that is based on exploitation and based on oppression. You were talking quite a bit with Allo Black, your last guest, about the whole criminalized, demonized position of Black people in this society. This is part of the judicial system, okay? It's rooted in capitalist exploitation here and around the world, and it has white supremacy and male supremacy woven into it. And so the Supreme Court is not challenging those fundamental assumptions. The Supreme Court, it protects a legal system where you have the right to exploit, but you don't have the right to eat. You know, so it's an administrative body, a judicial body that oversees a system of capitalism that does have white supremacy and patriarchy woven into it. And so it has at times been forced through people's mass resistance, through struggle, through people challenging and changing what they'll put up with in terms of a lot of the oppression that has been part of this country. It has at times been forced to give concessions to the oppressed. And I think this is a situation like that. You know, it's trying to mediate a situation where you have an incredibly polarized country on a number of questions. But just to think about the position of women, you have a huge millions of people who are whipped up around the notion that women have gotten out of their places and they need to be forced back under the thumb of men, even though they've never gotten out from the thumb of men, but forced back into the position of being property of men, forced back into the position of being breeders of children above all else, forced back into the dictates of a patriarchal, male-dominated Christian fascist view of the way the world should be. And so you have huge numbers of people who've been fighting this, and they've been passing the anti-abortion restrictions. They've been harassing women at the clinics. They've been the ones who shot up the Planned Parenthood 6 months ago in Colorado, murdering people. They've killed 8 abortion doctors and providers. This is a very serious movement. And then you have millions of people who feel very strongly that women should not be treated as property and are horrified by that and find that very notion illegitimate. And so the Supreme Court has been for a number of years trying to figure out how to hold that together. And this is a positive ruling, but it's still mediating those things. And it doesn't recognize, and I don't think under capitalism, under the American system of capitalism, you're going to have a recognition of the full humanity of women. I do want to say, I'll just work this in now, is that, because I don't know how long we have, but I do want to say that when I talk about the resistance and the struggle that has been part of wrenching the advances that have come, including when they've been granted by the Supreme Court or acceded to by the Supreme Court, I want to give a shout out especially, and I know you gave us airtime quite a bit when this was going on, to everybody who was involved with the revolution clubs, with the Movement for Revolution, and with StopPatriarchy.org when we did something that was objectively very unique and critical to this whole battle, and I'm sure has fed into the Supreme Court decision, which was to go to the front lines, to travel the country, to go and put our bodies on the line up in North Dakota, down in Mississippi, down in Texas, on the abortion rights, freedom rides, and other forms of resistance. We really played a unique role in saying, one, this fight is about women. It's women's enslavement or women's liberation. It's not just some matter of privacy in the abstract or health care in the abstract. It's about the enslavement of women. And women need abortion to control their lives and their reproduction and force children against their will is a form of enslavement. And so we took that message across the country and we broadcast that and we put our bodies on the line behind it. We got arrested in Texas many times standing up against this law that has now been thrown out. We traveled, we shut down the March for Life for the first time in 40 years. People got arrested doing that as well. There's been an important role that's been played and there needs to be much, much more of that. Of course, this wouldn't have been one without the providers stepping up and challenging the laws and staying on the front lines, but there's been a unique role and there needs to be much more of that. So I do want to recognize that.
All right. I hate to do this, but I have to give you a minute to sort of get in your last thoughts on this because we're really running behind.
Yeah, no, I know we're short on time. So I guess I would tell people, look, the fight is not over. And for myself, and I would challenge you, if you want a world where women's most fundamental rights are not being encroached upon, battled, and hanging by a thread, you need to step up and be part of resisting this battle for women's right to abortion is not over. Join with us in this and get serious about an actual revolution to overturn the system, to overthrow the system and build a world where all the chains on women and the other sections of humanity who are oppressed are broken. And I would urge you to go to www.revcom.us. I'd urge you to get the Revolution Nothing Less film from Bob Avakian. There is nothing that is going to illuminate more how these crimes are woven into the fabric and foundation of this system from its founding in slavery and genocide to today, but also illuminate the way out of this, the strategy, the scientific approach, a concrete vision of the world we're fighting for, and the leadership that Bob Avakian is providing. So I would go to that website. I'd watch the Revolution Nothing Less film. I think that's where I'll end it for now.
All right, and we'll talk to you again soon, Sansara. Thanks a lot for being here today.
All right, thanks, Michael.
Take care.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
All right, welcome back. That was We Will Not Go Down by Michael Hart.
Just recently, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed a decree ordering state agencies to divest from companies and institutions that adhere to the Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions movement, the BDS movement that exists in opposition to Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people and stands with the Palestinian people across the board. And joining us to talk about this is Charlotte Silver. Charlotte is a regular writer for the Electronic Intifada. She's based in Oakland, California, and she's reported from Palestine since 2010. Charlotte, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into this. What exactly is it that Andrew Cuomo has done?
So on June 6th, which also happened to mark the 49th anniversary of Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, signed an executive order that says that all state agencies cannot enter into contract or must discontinue any contract with groups, companies, or institutions or organizations who participate in the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. So it's a pretty vague and broad order. And so as part of the law, the state will actually be compiling a list of all of those institutions and companies that participate in the BDS movement. And so it's extraordinary, not only because you see the government collating groups whose political positions the government disagrees with, but it's also leveraging the government's economic power to actually compel political obedience or compel groups into a political position that they might not otherwise take.
You know, it's amazing. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to point out that New York State is not the first to sort of legislate a blacklist of companies and groups that are participating in the boycott of Israel. Several other states, including Illinois, Colorado, Arizona, and Florida, have passed laws to such effect. But New York is the first state to circumvent the legislative process the way Cuomo did by signing an executive order. And he did it because, in fact, New York had two pending laws that were very similar to the executive order that were sort of trying to get the state to disengage and boycott groups that were boycotting. But they were facing a lot of opposition in the legislature. The session was coming to an end. One of the bills had been basically tabled, and another one was facing a lot of opposition. So he did this, you know, he said it when he made his announcement. He said that he was trying to avoid the tedious legislative process. Well, he was also avoiding any sort of democratic process. And so I think that you see efforts to squash the BDS movement are having to resort to undemocratic means.
It's really intense because when I look at it and I see what Cuomo is saying, what you point out in your article, it actually comes off like a mafia threat. I mean, he's saying to these companies, if you boycott against Israel, and it's not just companies either. I mean, as I understand it, he's going after individuals as well, you know, and he's saying if you boycott against Israel, New York's going to boycott you. If you divert revenues from Israel, New York will divert revenues from you. If you sanction Israel, New York will sanction you too, period. And if you want to sleep with the fishes, New York will take care of that too. So there you go.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's to be seen how the list will be composed. They said it's going to take 6 months for his commissioner to compile the list. So it'll be interesting to see who makes it onto that list. Is it going to be churches and unions who have signed on to the BDS movement, or is it going to be actual corporations, foreign corporations, who have announced that they're withdrawing from their investments in Israel because they're no longer profitable or they're reputationally damaging? You know, in Illinois, for example, they have a law where their pension board has to divest. They've actually drawn up a blacklist of companies for their pension board to divest from. And G4S, the international security firm G4S, is actually on that list. G4S is the farthest thing you can get from a company that supports the BDS movement, but they announced recently that they were going to be withdrawing their work in Israeli prisons and along Israel's wall because they said it was no longer economically profitable. But it's arguable, and there's a lot of evidence to support that it was also damaging their reputation, and they were trying to get out of contracts that they're trying to, you know, improve their image. So companies making sort of capital decisions to divest from Israel going to be included on this list?
Yes. There you go.
We'll see.
It seems, according to Cuomo, huh? You know, you do anything at all similar, even vaguely similar to what you're talking about, yeah, you're on.
But I think that the point that you made that, you know, really he's trying to just sort of bully and sort of create this sort of drumbeat of a threat to penalize and near to criminalize boycotting and involvement in the BDS movement, it is ultimately, it's more of a threat than anything else. And in fact, BDS and anti-Zionist activity and speech is not criminalized in the U.S. And despite all the efforts on behalf of Israel and Israel advocacy groups to criminalize speech, to get anti-Zionist activities and speech outlawed on university campuses, they haven't been successful. And in fact, all of their efforts have resulted in the affirmation that anti-Zionist speech is lawful and is protected as First Amendment speech. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we see, right now we're seeing more than 20 states have laws pending. 9 states have actually passed laws that try to sort of penalize BDS activity in one way or another, like in New York. And they haven't yet been challenged in court because they haven't necessarily been implemented yet. But I wouldn't be surprised that once we go forward, if we do see rights to boycott being affirmed once again, because as of now, BDS, boycotting, and, you know, other activities to that effect have been repeatedly affirmed as protected First Amendment speech.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Charlotte Silva. Charlotte is an independent journalist and regular writer for the Electronic Intifada. She's based in Oakland, California, and has reported from Palestine since 2010. And today we're talking about the New York governor's decree that escalates Israel's fight against BDS, okay, that actually takes a stand against BDS in favor of, on the side of, the Israeli government and regime. You know, part of the thing that it's troubling, too, is because when you're talking about all this, I'm thinking about how sensitive this country and the people that run this country are in terms of the need to stand with 100% stand behind Israel. Even when they say they have, you know, they have some contradictions or whatever, it never comes down to fundamental or really kind of like, okay, this is deal breaking. You've gone too far. It's very much, they are very, very much tied to the support of Israel. I mean, look, they as far as I can see it, they need Israel there. They need Israel to actually, you know, in terms of how they see the world being divided up over there, this place where they can have actually sort of like their own sort of version of the old West Fort in amongst all the enemy people over there. And it's a place that has always stood with the U.S. and no matter what it does. And when I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, you know, wow, it's pretty heavy, because when they say this stuff to people, they're actually saying that there's a political reason for them. And they're actually saying this, that there's a political reason, you know, at least in reality, they're saying this, there's a political reason for them going after this. And I was thinking about this when you look at Cuomo himself is a pretty died in the wool, all out, everything to the wind, you know, supporter of Israel, no matter what. You go through in your article a whole sort of listing of the kinds of things where he stands in relation to this, some of which I thought was really heinous.
Right, like being, you know, one of the only U.S. politicians to go to Israel while it was bombing Gaza in 2014 and sort of, you know, doing Israel's PR work for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, and the thing that he came out and said is that he said, he's talked about visiting the tunnels, the infamous tunnels that Israel is taking all these journalists to and saying, these are the ways that they're sneaking in from Gaza to, you know, attack the Israeli people and to attack Israeli military targets. And Cuomo comes back and says, as frightening as those tunnels are, the BDS movement is in many ways more frightening, which is a pretty heavy thing to be saying about the BDS movement. Mm-hmm.
It is. But I also think that he's making a political bid. He also, in his speech, he made a jab at Bernie Sanders for, you know, even daring to question, you know, 100% support of Israel's military actions. And so in a way, he was also sort of trying to affirm the Democratic Party's allegiance to Israel. One of his last lines was, the Democratic Party is more pro-Israel than the Republican Party, no matter what. No matter what one of the candidates in the race says, the Democratic Party is Israel's greatest ally. This goes beyond just trying to actually affect popular opinion, because it's so disconnected from what's actually happening on the ground. It's so disconnected from the fact that BDS is growing. It's growing on campuses, it's growing in community groups, it's growing in trade unions. It's not just in the States, it's also in Europe and abroad. And so, you know, Cuomo's also, you know, he's making a political play on behalf of the Democratic Party, the sort of the guardians of the Democratic Party as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, and exactly as I'm listening to it, I was thinking, well, in a certain sense, that's exactly why they have to, you know, reach out and do these kinds of things against BDS, because this is sort of something that can threaten very seriously. And they're one of their most important allies in the world. And in today's world, it's extremely important for them to have Israel as sort of the bulldog in the desert that'll take care of their interests. Because I was thinking about Bernie Sanders when you bring him up. I mean, look, all Bernie Sanders said was that, well, you know, Israel's support, I mean, and the fact that he even just recognized the humanity of Palestinian people was enough to send them into a tailspin. And then they also said, you know, the growling dogs barking at the windows and stuff. And then he said, you know, and he didn't say Israel should have done this. He said Israel had a sort of disproportionate response. So it was actually a very light assault against, it wasn't an assault against Israel.
Right.
It basically was a criticism, a gentle criticism. But he paid hell for that.
And every time he said something slightly critical of Israel, he's also stated how also in support of Israel's security and right to exist as a Jewish state. And he's made all these other sort of overtures to pro-Israel advocacy constituents and demographics.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the people who stepped up to oppose what Cuomo has done.
That's, you know, yeah, Cuomo's bill has received a huge backlash, not only from sort of the usual suspects like the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights, but also, interestingly, the Anti-Defamation League, which is ardently pro-Israel organization and is also anti-BDS, has come out against anti-BDS legislation. And I think one of the reasons why they have done so is they see how these sort of undemocratic measures don't make Israel look good. If the governor of New York has to resort to an executive decree to get people to not support the boycott of Israel, then that means that doesn't make Israel look very good. You know, if they can't appeal to people on a moral basis, but only by threatening to end a contract, then Israel is not winning the argument. And I think the ADL knows this to some degree, and they see how all of the millions of dollars that have been poured into trying to clamp down on speech related to criticizing Israel has really backlashed against these groups and against this agenda. So I think the ADL is kind of trying to mitigate that to a certain degree.
Well, there's also groups, some of the Palestinian groups and whatnot, that have talked about it as a real assault on the First Amendment and on First Amendment rights and the freedom of speech, right?
Certainly. And I think it certainly is. It's blatant attack on protected speech, free speech activity. But I think that people feel more committed as ever to continue their work. And I haven't heard, I think that, you know, this kind of bullying is not going to be effective when it comes down to actually how people are going to organize and mobilize against it.
Mm-hmm. Now, just one last question. Cuomo has said that he sees the BDS as one of the most dangerous enemies of Israel. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that it's very interesting. I mean, I think it's very clear that Israel, by the fact that how much resources and money Israel has poured into defeating BDS, the same week that Cuomo signed his executive order, the American Anthropological Association narrowly voted down an academic boycott. And as soon as they did that, you have the Israeli public security minister talking to reporters and taking credit for this defeat. And so they're intervening. They're not intervening just on the state level. They're intervening with student groups, with academic associations. They're getting into small grassroots attempts to build this movement, which is growing, because they clearly do see it as a threat. BDS's power lies not just in helping to build pressure on Israel via economic isolation, but it's an extraordinary educational tool, and it's proven to be very effective.
And on that point, a very important point to end up on. And Charlotte, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Okay. And where can people find your writing again? It's in the Electronic Intifada, but you write for other places as well?
Yeah, electronicintifada.net is the best place to find my most current stuff.
All right, great. Thanks a lot, Charlotte.
Thank you.
Okay, take care now. Bye.
Bye.
All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Charlotte Silver. Charlotte's an independent journalist and regular writer for the Electronic Intifada. She's based in Oakland, California, and has reported from Palestine since 2010. And we've been talking about New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's recent decree ordering state agencies to divest from companies and institutions that adhere to the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement against the state of Israel. All right, well, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Alo Black, Sansara Taylor, and Charlotte Silver. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor, Alex Brenner, and Matt Kwiklinski. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Here is the Rose from Outer National. Talk to you again next week.
When nighttime his loneliness sinks in, you're getting in a mischief, I'm listening. I want to hear your thoughts, see it all. Waves through the walls. You wanna go out tonight. You want to know what it's like when the wind's in your lungs and the fire is in those.